You're listening to the Naked Genetics podcast with me, Dr. Kat Arney. Still to come, we'll be finding out why siblings aren't identical twins and getting to grips with tribbles, our furry gene of the month. One big area where sequencing technology has made an impact is in our understanding of the genetic faults and variations that increase our risk of different diseases. Often we'll see research in this field reported in terms such as scientists find new gene for cancer, heart disease, or whatever. But what does this actually mean? To find out, I spoke to Dr. Carl Anderson, a statistical geneticist at the Wellcome Trust Sanger Centre.
So I don't really like the term gene for, because we all have that gene, and that gene exists in our genome to encode a protein which has a certain function, and that the function of that protein is critical or is useful to everyday human life. That's why the gene is there, that's why the protein is made, and that's why the gene exists. What happens in certain individuals who have particular genetic conditions, and you know, where this term gene for comes from, is that there are specific mutations which occur in that gene, and it is those mutations in that gene that change the function of the gene. They change the way the protein functions, the abundancy with which the protein is present in our system, the folding of the protein. They make some subtle change to that protein that then changes our risk. So it's not true that you know, this is a gene for breast cancer, let's say. That's not why that gene exists. It's not present in our genome to cause breast cancer. It has some other function that when there's a particular mutation in that gene, that then increases risk for breast cancer or whatever the disease happens to be.
So we should start talking about a mutation for breast cancer or heart disease rather than a gene for...
Exactly, because we all have that gene, and quite likely if you didn't have that gene, you'd be in quite a lot of trouble.
And what sort of diseases would you class as a single gene disease? And what sort of diseases are these multifactorial diseases?
So the single gene diseases are things like cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease. They're the type of diseases that actually, you know, when you study genetics at school, then these are the type of diseases which you get taught, or you know, taught as genetic diseases. They're the ones where you have the pedigree diagrams and you look to see whether mum has a disease or dad has a disease and how many of the children have the disease, and you can see a very clear inheritance pattern. These are the classic Mendelian diseases, the single gene diseases. The more complex diseases are probably the ones that have a greater frequency in the population. So things like autoimmune diseases, so type 1 diabetes, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, then things like most cancers, things like hypertension, and not just diseases, you know, there are genetic influences on lots of human traits, so your height, your weight, your overall body shape, all of these human traits have genetic influences, and assessing how important genetics is to each of these traits is a complex thing to do, and that's one of the jobs of a human geneticist. And once we've found out that perhaps genetics has a large role to play in some of these diseases, our next job is to go on and identify those specific regions of the genome that look to be underpinning that genetic risk.
So how on earth do you do that? How do you pin down a region of the genome or a particular gene and say, right, that's involved in heart disease, that's involved in schizophrenia?
It's surprisingly simple, actually. So basically what we do is we take a whole bunch of people who have the disease and a whole bunch of people who don't have the disease. So how big is a bunch? Well, it really depends on the size of the genetic effect that you're trying to find. So if you think that the particular disease you're working on is likely to have genetic effects which are a relatively small effect, let's say, then you're going to need lots of people to do this experiment in. So in the last 5 years or so, we've started doing these genome-wide association studies. And so what typically happens in a genome-wide association study is we take, say, 3,000 people who have a disease and we compare them to 3,000 people who don't have a disease, and we genotype them at a whole bunch of various positions throughout the genome. And so we end up having, say, 500,000 or 1,000,000 sites throughout each of these people's genomes, and then we just look to see if at any of these particular sites there is a difference between the people who do have the disease and people who don't have the disease. And then if we find a site where there's a difference, we just look in the reference databases that we have to find whereabouts in the genome that, you know, that particular site is, what genes lie near it, and does that actually tell us then something about that particular disease?
Presumably you're not looking at these millions of different variations by eye with a pencil. How do you analyse this kind of data?
So the type of science that we do at Sanger and these genome-wide associations is extremely high throughput, in the sense that, you know, you've got lots of genetic data across many thousands of individuals, so the data sets are very large. So we have to use the computational tools, basically, to go in and conduct statistical tests at each one of these sites. And then when we're analysing the results of that, we have to bear in mind how many tests we've performed to try and make sure that, you know, obviously you're doing many tests, and so the chance of you finding a false positive is quite high, and so you need to control for all that. So we basically use the computers to allow us to analyse all this data very quickly and efficiently, and we use statistical methods to try and pull out from all those many thousands and thousands of tests the few interesting sites that remain.
Where do you think this kind of research is going to be heading in the future?
We've been relatively limited to the amount of a particular person's genome that we can survey. So before, we've been just genotyping specific sites in the genome, perhaps a million sites, and using those 1 million sites throughout the genome to try and infer what's going on throughout the whole genome. Now, with the advent of next generation sequencing, we can get hold of virtually every single base in any particular person's genome. So we've got much more thorough coverage of one person's genome. And so this really increases the power of our studies. Also, with the falling costs of those technologies, we can start to do that very thorough survey on many thousands and thousands of people. And so I think what this is going to allow us to do is it basically allows us to survey more of the genetic architecture of the diseases. Before, we were limited to genetic variants, which were perhaps quite common in the population, whereas now we can actually start to survey down to genetic variants which are perhaps very rare in the population. And indeed, we can probably even get at those specific variants which are unique to any one individual person.
Do you think that one day in the not too distant future, we'll actually, when a baby is born, it will have some blood taken, it will have its genome sequenced?
I think that's extremely likely. I think the potential medical benefits are quite huge, and I really think that we'll be there soon.
That was Carl Anderson from the Wellcome Trust Sanger Centre.